Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, Congress caved in on a White House push to expand its surveillance powers under the Orwell Protect America Act. Some major newspapers wrote blistering editorials against the act, but the news pages and TV coverage often made the dispute nearly impossible to follow. Azeez Huq of NYU's Brennan Center for Justice will join us to try and explain what happened. Also on the show, Hillary Clinton says she will take money from lobbyists. Obama and Edwards say they won't. But everyone's getting money from somewhere, and tracking it is journalism 101 in an election year, or should be. Hoping to help shed light on the matter is a new project, WhiteHouseForSale.org, from the folks at Public Citizen. We'll talk to Laura McCleary about forcing candidates to let in the sunlight on fundraising. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Most of the Democratic presidential contenders turned up at the yearly COSE convention, a gathering of liberal bloggers and internet activists. That drew much more media attention to the event than you'd expect. Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly waged a campaign against the COSE website, likening it to Nazi-style hate. Few others in the press seemed willing to jump aboard that train, but some of the commentary about the meeting was puzzling. The Washington Post wrote about the, quote, blogs' growing influence as powerful backroom players in Democratic circles, and the fact that they don't reflect the views of most Democrats, much less the general public, close quote. Well, since blogs are on the, you know, internet, it's hard to suggest that they're shadowy backroom dealmakers. As for the idea that they're not representative of the public, well, how so? Many bloggers are solidly against the Iraq War and critical of the Bush administration, both of which are pretty mainstream viewpoints. On August 4th, NBC Nightly News correspondent John Yang made the same point, noting that in an unscientific Daily Kos readers poll, John Edwards came in first and Hillary Clinton came in third. That's the opposite of NBC's polling, and hence very out of line with the rest of the country. Well, a reader poll can't really be compared with an opinion survey, but even if it could, so what? Media outlets like NBC spend big money on early polling, but they're a terrible gauge of how voters will actually behave. The point of all this is that this gathering was bad for Democrats, especially when it comes to the Iraq War. As Cokie Roberts warned on NPR, quote, getting into this position with these activists at this point in the campaign can be dangerous in the long run, close quote. Yes, the danger of siding with the majority of Americans who want to end the war.
Given corporate media's record of generating spurious debate about global warming, despite the overwhelming scientific consensus on the matter, some readers could be forgiven for doing a double take at Newsweek's August 13th cover line, "Global Warming is a Hoax." Of course, the article turned out to be about efforts by contrarian scientists, think tanks, and naturally industry to deny the realities of warming and resist moves to respond to it. All of which is fine, just somewhat less remarkable than John Meacham's self-congratulatory editor's note would seem to imply. Evidently feeling that an article that accepts the science on the issue needs defending on ideological grounds, Meacham declares, quote, "Our story is not a piece of lefty cant. Honest, well-meaning people can disagree about what we should do about climate change, but it is increasingly difficult to maintain that the problem simply does not exist or is a minor threat," close quote. Actually, those words, "it is increasingly difficult to maintain that the problem does not exist," were true at least as early as the early 1990s, when an overwhelming majority of climate scientists told Gallup that human-induced global warming was indeed underway. Perhaps it didn't get the attention it merited because it was reported by repositories of lefty cant. In any event, it's hardly a bold statement in 2007. Perhaps most irritating in Newsweek's pat on its own back for reporting on what the piece calls the denial machine is the failure to mention that two prominent cogs in that machine, George Will and Robert Samuelson, use Newsweek itself as a megaphone for their denial. If the magazine really believes, as Meacham writes, that, quote, "to reflexively deny the scientific consensus does a disservice to the debate," close quote, perhaps they should stop publishing columns that do that.
George Bush has a habit of telling lies and falsehoods. but media have seldom squarely confronted Bush on his mendacity. So after Bush's August 6th claim that Iran, quote, has proclaimed its desire to build a nuclear weapon, close quote, it was refreshing to see a same-day report challenging that falsehood. It went like this, quote, U.S. President George W. Bush charged Monday that Iran has openly declared that it seeks nuclear weapons, an inaccurate accusation at a time of sharp tensions between Washington and Tehran, close quote. Well, unfortunately for U.S. readers, that was the lead from an Agence France-Presse story. So how did the U.S. media do with the White House disinformation? Not well, actually. As the blog Left Eye on the News found, the New York Times tried to soften the Bush falsehood, reporting only that Bush, quote, has long viewed Iran as a state sponsor of terrorism and is deeply suspicious of its nuclear ambitions, a view he reiterated Monday, close quote. The Washington Post didn't do much better, according to the blog. Its report waited until the second-to-last paragraph to tell readers that Bush's claim was untrue. In mea culpas admitting their credulous roles in the run-up to the Iraq War, the Times and Post both pledged to show more scrutiny for government pronouncements in the future. They just have a funny way of showing it.
Republican representative and presidential candidate Tom Tancredo has been making some remarkable comments lately, saying that the U.S. should threaten to bomb Muslim holy sites in Mecca and Medina as a deterrent for any Islamic fundamentalists thinking of attacking the U.S. This just shows we mean business, says Tancredo spokeswoman Bay Buchanan. To many people, it just showed the extreme wackiness of Tancredo's worldview. But even though a State Department spokesperson called the comments absolutely crazy, the best the New York Times could do in their August 6th write-up was the headline, Tancredo Takes a Tough Stance. Then again, maybe the idea of indiscriminate bombing as a deterrent to violence just isn't deemed all that weird at the Times. The paper did, after all, run a piece by Ted Koppel in October 2006, in which the former Nightline host argued that Iran should be permitted to develop nuclear weapons, with one catch, quote, if a dirty bomb explodes in Milwaukee or some other nuclear device detonates in Baltimore or Wichita, if Israel or Egypt or Saudi Arabia should fall victim to a nuclear accident, Iran should understand that the United States government will not search around for the perpetrator. The return address will be predetermined, and it will be somewhere in Iran, close quote.
And finally, after the Democrats' debate on August 7th, MSNBC reporter David Schuster weighed in with what the cable channel called a Truth Squad report. But Schuster seemed only to rebut the opinions he didn't care for. First up was Chris Dodd's criticism of Barack Obama for saying that if there were actionable intelligence that Al-Qaeda operatives in Pakistan could be attacked, and the Pakistani government failed to take action, quote, we will, close quote. Dodd said unilateral action was dangerous, and Obama responded by saying, quote, I did not say we would immediately go in unilaterally, close quote. While this would hardly seem to be a controversial proposition, Schuster said Obama was incorrect and misleading. Well, not exactly. Obama's speech pledged to make military aid to Pakistan conditional on their efforts to crack down on Al-Qaeda, and he also spoke of non-military assistance to that country. But if that one seems less than worthy of a fact check, consider the rest of Schuster's report. John Edwards said he marched on 200 picket lines. Schuster's truth? Well, a Chicago paper said he was at one picket line for just 10 minutes. Glad that one was straightened out. The last two items on Schuster's list, candidates who, quote, gave some untruthful descriptions of the Bush administration, close quote. And what were they? Hillary Clinton said her administration's New Orleans reconstruction effort would be headed by someone, quote, who actually cared about the people of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, close quote. And Joe Biden remarked that George W. Bush has ruined the country. In what way would those be considered untruthful? Schuster didn't really say. One can only guess he's offended by their tone. If that's the case, he might want to consider a different beat. Political candidates have been known to sharply criticize their opponents. That's kind of the point.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
If you found the recent battle in Congress over wiretapping, data mining, and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act a little hard to follow, the press wasn't making it easy for you. It's fair to ask how they could have made this dispute easier to parse. Joining us now to do that is Aziz Huq. He's the head of the Liberty and National Security Project of the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. Aziz Huq, welcome to Counterspin.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Now, what's at stake in all of this seems to be as good a place to start as any. One CBS Evening News report spoke about the bill this way, quote, a rather prickly intelligence bill that has to do with tapping into communications between potential terrorists, close quote. ABC World News talked about the, quote, government's power to eavesdrop on foreign terror suspects without getting a warrant, close quote. Those descriptions don't make it sound like much to worry about. What's actually going on here?
Well, Peter, I think those descriptions are at best incomplete in two ways. The first way is that they focus on the legitimate use of the law, the focus on terrorists. And the second way is that they focus on communications that are wholly overseas, people who are not located at all in the United States. And what they draw attention away from is the manner in which this law, the Protect America Act of 2007, while it may have a small set of legitimate uses, in effect, it sweeps much more broadly to encompass not just people who are alleged or suspected to be terrorists, does not just cover people who are located overseas, but in fact allows a substantial amount of warrantless surveillance of Americans for the first time as a matter of statutory law since the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was passed in 1978.
And one aspect of it that I think got some attention was the idea that the oversight of this program will be squarely the business of the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence. So there doesn't seem to be even this FISA court overseeing the mechanics of the program.
That's basically right, Peter. The administration and the administration's allies on the recent news shows have said, well, look, this law contains both a judicial and a congressional oversight provision. The problem is that both of those oversight provisions are wholly toothless. And what we've had is a lot of reporting about, well, there is a judicial oversight, there is a congressional oversight provision in the law, but really insufficient attention to the fact that these are really shallow or hollow oversight mechanisms. They are, as you say, mechanisms that essentially mean that a court or Congress will check off on something that has been authorized and examined in its details in the first instance by the Attorney General and by the Director of National Intelligence, who's now Mike McConnell.
Now, the beginnings of this discussion are kind of interesting, and you go through this in your piece on the Nation's website. There was this ruling by a secret FISA court this summer. Oddly enough, this seemed to be leaked by the administration or their allies in order to help the White House make a public case that there was just this minor technical issue, that the way phone traffic works, a lot of the bits of data show up in the United States, even though the calls are overseas. So we just need to fix this little problem with the technology. The law was written 30 years ago, and it didn't imagine this. How did we get from there to the law that was eventually passed?
Well, I think that there is a narrow technical problem. And it's true that this law fixes the narrow technical problem, but that's probably 1% of the effect of the law. A focus on 1% of the problem is really quite misleading. The way we got from that to the law that we have is really, on the one hand, the administration negotiating with the Dems on a real fix. And in fact, you had a proper fix negotiated directly between the Democratic leadership in the House and the Senate on the one hand, and the DNI, McConnell, on the other hand. McConnell takes it back to the White House. The White House says, no, this is not what we want. What we want is the whole hog. And in the very limited time that remained of the congressional session, you had the White House really able to stampede the Congress into passing something that it had not looked at carefully, either in terms of the specific language of the law or in terms of the real need that obtains in the NSA's operation.
You wrote about the irony here, and this is related to a couple of issues where the administration loses in court and somehow ends up gaining more in the discussions or in the debate with Congress after this. Well, the media is where we learn about these things. The New York Times broke the story of the surveillance program. USA Today broke the story of the NSA monitoring these telecommunications switches. Nonetheless, it's still hard to follow this debate in the press. Do you think that the debate gets too technical for a lot of reporters, or is the White House just too clever at manipulating things?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. I don't think that any of the issues here are so difficult. Either an average citizen or an average reporter can't understand them. I think that they're understandable and they're straightforward. I think that the key question, as always, is the framing question. How do you present issues to the public that may be complex in ways that highlight one or other facade? And this administration is one that has been very, very effective in highlighting what they want to highlight in ways that obscure very, very serious problems. And part of that is the fact that terrorism or talk about terrorist suspects, for example, is something of a conversation stopper. Mm-hmm. As soon as you say somebody's a terrorist suspect, well, that's the end of it. We don't need to worry about them. The problem, of course, is that and this is the problem that the media never picks or very rarely picks up on. The government thinks people are suspects all the time, and it's often wrong. And the whole point of having processes, the whole point of having institutions, the whole point of having a Bill of Rights is to make sure that the government doesn't get it wrong. And so the framing of the issue as, is this a bad guy or is this not a bad guy? And if it's a bad guy, we can spy on them, we can do what have you to them. Mm-hmm. That misses out on what's really at stake in many of these cases, which is not a question of can we do this, but a question of how can we do this? And the media really hasn't done a good job of that second question.
Now, the program was blasted by the New York Times editorial page, the Washington Post editorial page, somewhat surprisingly, probably even more critical than the Times. Some of the critics are pointing out that, well, there is a silver lining here. This act expires in 6 months. You're not so sure that's anything to get excited about, a debate about the something called the Protect America Act in the middle of an election campaign.
Well, I think that there are two problems, Peter, and I think that one is the inevitable politicization that you will have of legislation on this kind of issue in a presidential campaign. It's ever since 2002, when you saw Max Cleland from Georgia being compared to Osama bin Laden in campaign ads, terrorism has been an issue that has been used with incredible irresponsibility in the partisan context. But even more troubling in my view than that is the fact that there has been reporting on the fact that this is there is a sunset provision in the law which says that the powers granted in the law will end after 6 months. And many people have failed to pick up on the fact that the sunset provision is artfully crafted to allow the administration to reauthorize the program for a year, the day before the law sunsets, and to have the program going on for a whole a year minus a day, after the law has sunset. So whether or not this law sunsets and whether or not it's authorized, what is allowed under it will continue going at least until the end of the present administration, absent some other legislative action, which is obviously very unlikely.
We've been speaking with Aziz Hook of the Liberty and National Security Project of the Brennan Center for Justice, part of the New York University School of Law. You can read his article, Data Mining Our Liberties, at thenation.com. Aziz Hook, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Peter.
As media handicap the 2008 presidential race, there's one factor we haven't heard much about yet. Nevertheless, if history is a guide, the American non-voter will play a major role in the next election. Ask many folks why they don't take part, and the answer is often some variation of money, money, money. Simply put, there are many people who are just not convinced that a vote is a vote is a vote in this country, and the idea that you have to pay to play makes them question the whole process. Making elections more free and fair is a long-term struggle, but blowing away some of the smoke around how candidates raise their money and from whom seems like a basic part of it. That's the spur behind WhiteHouseForSale.org, a new project from the group Public Citizen. We're joined now by phone from Washington, D.C., by Laura McCleary, Director of Public Citizen's Congress Watch Division. Welcome to Counterspin, Laura McCleary.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, many folks will know about the recent dust-up between Democratic presidential candidates. Hillary Clinton declared that she would continue to accept funding from lobbyists. Barack Obama and John Edwards criticized that stance. But we know that they do have bundlers, those big donors who direct money to candidates, who can funnel more money than individuals are allowed to do. So on just the narrow point, first of all, is this a distinction without a difference here between lobbyists and bundlers?
Well, I do think that it's an important distinction, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
The lobbyist who is acting as a campaign fundraiser is often a Washington insider who has a variety of clients in their portfolio, and they're particularly well placed to pivot between corporate interests and government institutions in order to win loopholes, earmarks, and other goodies for their corporate clients. So I think it is a good step forward. And of course, it's been incredibly useful to have this conversation elevated to this level about the role of money in politics. However, the bundler situation is far from satisfactory. And there are plenty of reasons why you might say that a bundler who is a corporate officer, like a CEO for a major corporation and is acting as a fundraiser for a presidential campaign, probably has interests that are fairly similar to any lobbyist in terms of winning favors for that company. So we do need a lot more disclosure on what the role of bundlers have been and are going to be in the presidential races. And that's the purpose of our website at White House for Sale.
Well, briefly then, how forthcoming are the candidates being about their fundraising sources? What are the basic things reporters and the public should know and don't know at this point?
The disclosure of bundling activity in this campaign has been dismal. And it's a sorry day when you're looking to Bush and Cheney as, you know, masters of disclosure. We know about their notorious secrecy around information, and yet they disclosed more and routinely in the 2004 election than any of the candidates are disclosing today, and that applies both to the Democratic and Republican fields. Among the candidates, Senator Barack Obama has disclosed the most. He provides the information on a readily available website, and he is giving the names of his bundlers. However, he is not providing their employment data, which is really important for groups like ours to be able to know that the records that were cross-listing with government records on contributions from agencies are the same individuals that are referenced on his bundlers list. The rest of the candidates are really ill-defined in terms of what they're disclosing. They are disclosing the names, but usually the sources are very obscure and difficult to find where they're disclosing it. They don't seem to be updating them regularly. And the way that the candidates are defining bundlers differs from candidate to candidate. And none of the candidates are disclosing how much bundling every bundler is doing, that is, how many donations they are forwarding, except in very broad categories of about $50,000. So we just need better information. We need a requirement that this information be disclosed, and we need it to be regularly available to the public as the election season continues.
The Washington Post had a story on August 7th about bundlers tapping their employees and clients for contributions to the campaign of whatever candidate they're backing, a kind of semi-coerced contribution. I was struck by the line, quote, "Bundlers have become so ingrained in the fundraising process that some websites keep track of who they are," close quote. That sounded kind of like the minimal expectation you would have that there would actually be information available about these key players in the democratic process. So that struck me. But it went on to say, but Congress recently acted to create more transparency when the bundlers are lobbyists. Does that lobbying legislation get at the types of questions that you're asking?
Well, it will be a tremendous help. The Lobbying and Ethics Reform Bill that just passed through the Congress does require additional disclosure of bundling activity for both congressional candidates and for presidential candidates insofar as it pertains to lobbyists, so people who are registered lobbyists with the Secretary of the Senate and the Clerk of the House. That will increase the amount of information that we have about which bundlers by the candidates are lobbyists. However, that does not substitute for a rule that would require candidates to disclose all of their bundlers, lobbyists and non-lobbyists. And on our website, we have indicated when a disclosure comes from a particular candidate in a press release or when it's covered by a news report. And a significant number of the bundlers that we've uncovered actually have only been reported about in the news, which means that we're really piecing together hundreds of sources to produce the information that's available here. And it's been months and months of work for this one organization. It shouldn't be that way. It should be that this information is readily available and that the candidates are the ones to supply it.
Well, in an editorial that was supporting that lobbyist reform legislation, the New York Times referred to the need to track what they called the bundler's quid pro quo money flow. But it seems to me like even in articles about fundraising, the reports don't often enough bring home the point that it isn't just about people putting money into campaigns. It's about that they expect to get something in return for their money. I mean, that's really the rock bottom issue here, isn't it?
Absolutely. But it's very difficult to follow those through the process. I mean, oftentimes the congressional subsidies that are put into a bill or the earmarks might benefit more than one company or even more than one industry. And so to really point to the exchange is quite difficult, except when you have cases of outright bribery, as you did in the Abramoff example, or you have grotesque examples where people are allowed on the inside to write legislation, as was Ken Lay, the former head of Enron, on the Cheney Task Force on Energy. Both Lay and Abramoff were bundlers for the Bush campaign at different points in their elections.
Well, finally, how would you hope that journalists and the public would use WhiteHouseForSale.org?
I would hope that they would come onto the site, poke around, look at what their potential candidates are doing, and then that they would attend town hall or other electoral events and ask questions about why the candidates are not disclosing what they should disclose about the role of bundlers in their campaigns, and really put them on the spot about the inadequacies here and the right of the public to know what's going on behind the scenes.
We've been speaking with Laura McCleary, Director of Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. WhiteHouseForSale.org is exactly where you think it would be on the web. Thanks very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. The show is engineered by Bill Seary at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.